Hello, and welcome to The Real Real Talk. I'm Susan McCabe, your host, here with you every Tuesday at lunchtime to explore today's issues with experts who have some of the answers. I'm here today with Brian Check, who is the founder and executive director of the Center for the Advancement of the Steady State Economy. And Brian has some ideas about how the Democrats might use the gross domestic product to beat Trump in the election. Welcome, Brian.
Hi, Susan.
So you've got some very interesting ideas about how Democrats can use the condition of the GDP to beat our Trump, who runs on a lot on the health of the economy. What's your theory?
Well, it'd take a bold step by the Dems, but they have to, somebody's got to lead the way in developing and in leading the American public to have a different perspective on GDP and to start recognizing it for what it is, which is an indicator of more problems than solutions at this point in history. Because, you know, Trump's calling card is GDP growth, of course.
Yes.
That's his number one domestic policy goal. He said that right from the start. And, you know, it's his biggest boast is GDP growth. And so if we can start to, if the Democrats can begin to say, look, you know, growth, GDP growth is the cause of climate change and biodiversity loss and noise and stress and congestion, you know, then that undermines entirely that assumption that that growth is good and that Trump should be reelected based on that policy priority.
Well, and apparently you're not the only one who thinks so. You point out in your article at steadystate.org that both Cory Booker and Andrew Yang, dropped out Democratic presidential candidates, mentioned this. And Cory Booker's statement is very moving, very interesting to me. He says the indicators that are being used from GDP to Wall Street's rankings are not helping people in my community. It's about time that we have an economy that works for everybody, not just for the wealthiest in our nation. And Andrew Yang, as you pointed out, went just a little further. And he said, what we have to do is we have to say, look, there's record high GDP and stock market prices. You know what else there is are record highs, suicides, drug overdose, depression, anxiety. It's gotten so bad that American life expectancy has declined for the last 3 years. That's pretty profound. Where do we go with that? How many people beyond these two Democratic candidates and you are really considering the possibility that GDP is not sustainable?
Well, you have the whole ecological economics movement, which I say the whole, it's not a big movement, but pretty much the whole of it for what that's worth. And that resides largely in academia. But, you know, I think my point there is that there are groups of people that do recognize that at this point in history, the growth of GDP is really a bad thing more than a good thing. And therefore, in a sense, you might call it uneconomic growth, you know, growth that's causing, that's costing more than it's benefiting us. But, you know, the fact that Cory Booker and Andrew Yang said those things, I think that's a really good sign that there are both many other people that are getting that at this point, and that there are just very compelling logical grounds. Otherwise, you know, prominent politicians like that wouldn't be making such statements.
Sure. Yeah, that can be political suicide. But I'm sure that the counter arguments to that would be things like if we don't measure progress by gross domestic product, number one, what will we measure it by, and what kind of economic disaster would have to happen, or complete economic overturn would have to happen in order for us to move toward a more steady state economy? How does that work?
Well, there are a host of other indicators of welfare that can be used, that can be juxtaposed with GDP, so that we can get a sense of when GDP growth is becoming increasingly a bad deal. You know, things like the Living Planet Index and the ecological footprint and the measure of economic welfare. And then, you know, more and more there are efforts to measure happiness. And that's, you know, you even have some countries that have abandoned the pursuit of GDP growth, like Bhutan, and most recently New Zealand, that have stated specifically that that's not their goal, is to grow GDP, but rather to have happier people. And to get serious about that, they've developed some metrics like gross national happiness.
How do they measure that?
Well, you know, I'm not very well versed with the methodology, but I believe it's primarily a survey-based metric where they simply ask people. It's a little more nuanced than saying, "Hey, are you happy?"
Yeah.
Rated 1 to 10, there certainly must be a number of correlates with general mental welfare and signs of well-being at large that are associated, or that are basically the definition of happiness.
Well, currently, our economy is measured by how much we as a nation produce. The benefits of that production currently go to the companies and the kings or captains of industry who are making money on that, and of course their shareholders. So if we were to move to a steady state economy that is aimed at gross happiness, what would happen to things like corporations, and how would they continue, if at all? And how would they reconcile with the idea that they don't need to be increasing their production every year? They need to be doing what?
Well, I think the main thing is that there wouldn't be this sea change in the entire corporate structure necessarily. I mean, that's one way of going about being more conducive to a steady state economy. However, there are those of us, including myself, that think that you can have a stock market, you can have a significant number of corporations. It's just that they're not all going to be growing as fast as they can. And you might think of maybe like a popcorn popper. You know, you have so many kernels of corn that can be popped, and so much popcorn that can fit in there, and it's bouncing all over the place. There's similarly in the business world, there's competition all the time, and it's expected that some businesses are going to succeed and some aren't. And it's the ratio of those that make it to those that don't, that have to more closely be congruent with a stabilized size of the economy at large. And so, you know, it certainly is not a something that a corporate CEO that's making many millions of dollars a year and not paying many taxes likes to hear about. But for most other people, it's, of course, you know, we can have more and more people making many, many millions and not paying any taxes. and expect that to be sustainable. I think this stock market thing, you know, it's being attributed primarily to the coronavirus epidemic.
You mean the current stock market crashing or stock market adjustment, as they say? You're referring to that,
right? Yeah. I mean, I think it's it went down so fast because people also recognize that this isn't sustainable to see this kind of growth. It's not going to be reflected in the real economy when you have so many signs of stress to the environment that the real economy is ultimately dependent upon.
What role do you think tax incentives could play in beginning to move us from a growth economy to a steady state economy?
Well, they could play a huge role. If you are able to tax to the extent and also the right things that, for example, would stabilize the energy extraction to a sustainable level, then that's a very solid precondition to a steady state economy. And you've accomplished quite a huge step toward that by doing that. But typically, it's unlikely to be able to accomplish those types of tax reforms unless you have a policy to begin with that recognizes limits to growth and the need to establish a steady state economy.
So where does that policy have to begin?
The policy or the agreement that we need to get to a steady state economy?
Both.
So the policy, I think where that begins is we look at the current collection of policies that are geared toward growth. And these are, basically categorized as fiscal and monetary and trade policies. And so in fiscal policy, you know, the budgets and the tax codes, any clauses therein that are designed specifically for stimulating growth, those need to be reformed and redesigned specifically for well-being and sustainability.
Go ahead.
Yeah, that's our major legislative project, by the way, at CASI, the Center for the Advancement of the Steady State Economy, is reforming what we consider to be the central economic policy of the United States, which is the Employment Act, which hasn't had substantial amendments since 1978, when it was amended to become the Full Employment and Balanced Growth Act. And so that's when the U.S. government went into very explicitly the program of economic growth, you know, not just full employment, not just economic stability, not just containing inflation. It went whole hog into the program of GDP growth. And so that's legislation that's way outdated by now. It's very mid-20th century type legislation. And so that's a good starting point to reform that legislation, which contains elements of both fiscal and monetary policy.
I don't think a lot of our listeners are aware of that act or of its impact. In the history of the United States, 1970s is fairly recent. So it sounds to me like what you're saying is that the push for GDP as the measurement of our success as a nation really was amplified in the 70s and not necessarily before that. And that starts to make me feel like there is a bit of a separation between the focus on GDP growth and capitalism as a philosophy or a policy. Is that a reasonable assessment?
Well, Largely, it is, although the U.S. started measuring GDP in 1929 and then adopted a very formal approach to it in the early 1930s with the Bureau of Economic Analysis. And there was sort of an unstated or implicit assumption that, well, it's a good thing for GDP to grow. But then, you know, there was the argument between the Keynesians and, you know, the more conventional neoclassical economists about whether or not that meant that you should get the government involved in economic policy. And, well, fast forwarding some decades, you know, Nixon had the famous comment that we're all Keynesians now. Recognizing fully that the government is very much has effects on the rate of growth. And by the time that legislation in 1970, I should back up again for just a moment back to the 1940s. The original Employment Act was passed, I believe it was 1946. And it was passed to avoid the repeat of a Great Depression. Yes. And but it was focused on, you know, on maintaining employment, just like it sounded. It wasn't until the 1970s when it underwent significant amendment and became the Full Employment and Balanced Growth Act.
And so it sounds like, you know, that law, the 1970s Full Employment and Balanced Growth Act, tied the idea of employment to GDP.
Yes, it did. It did, and I don't want to make GDP sound entirely meaningless with regard to employment. There is, of course, a relationship between GDP and the number of jobs out there. But our point at Cassie and the point of people like Cory Booker and Andrew Yang, and I think more and more people all along, is that how many jobs can we expect to have? You know, there can't be trillions of jobs on a finite country like the U.S. or even the planet Earth. And so, and it used to be that economists would say, well, yeah, maybe there's some kind of limit, but that's so far off in the distance that that's not really relevant to policy at this time. Well, now it's extremely relevant.
Sure.
Yeah, so that's why we find some politicians finally starting to break the ice on that.
But if we can't come up with trillions of jobs for all the trillions of people in the world, what do we do?
Well, we better start planning now to limit the size of the economy. And frankly, I don't like to use the phrase population control, but on the other hand, the reality is that since we can't have trillions of jobs, that means that we can't have trillions of working-age people either, or even trillions of any kind of people.
Right. Yeah, right.
So,
well, and, you know, that
similar thing that we were talking about with policy reform, we start with the current policies that are designed to incentivize population growth. And so instead of, you know, having some sort of draconian policy like
like China had to impose
abortions or something hideous like that, we say, look, we're not going to intentionally advertise the fact that we're doling out more money to those couples that have more than two kids.
Yeah, that is sort of the third rail in politics, isn't it? When people start talking about population control, they run into really nasty roadblocks. And yet, in so many ways, that is one of the fundamental issues we are facing in climate crisis, and in economic crises. And that brings me to the question that you didn't really want me to ask you, but I'm going to, and that is about the impact of the COVID-19 epidemic on our economy. One of my first thoughts was, well, maybe there's a silver lining here, and that will the effect on the economy will be a retraction, so that we'll have to start looking at something other than economic growth, that we might have to learn to live with something steadier.
Right.
What do you say to that?
Well, basically, I agree. It is doing that. For those people that are looking at the issue with open mind and looking at all the ramifications and what it indicates as it does things like burst the bubble in the stock market and causes a major slowdown in activity in general, why hopefully people do recognize that as a sign of limits to growth and as a kind of a warning that, it's a pandemic, but it certainly is far from the worst we could imagine,
mm-hmm.
so far at least. The early indications are that it will at some point be controlled, or both naturally and with the help of the developments in, medical technology and so forth. But let's hope it's not worse than that. And meantime, let's take it as the indicator that it is, that, nature bats last.
I like that. Nature bats last. Well, and given that the GDP growth has been Trump's calling card, how do you think this potential retraction of the economy might affect his popularity?
Well, that's a very tricky question, because we at Cassie, we always felt that Trump's radical growthmanship was enough unto itself to demonstrate how stupid it is to pursue at all costs GDP growth.
Mm-hmm.
Now this coronavirus hits, and in a way, I suppose Trump's political response to that will be, well, it wasn't my fault that the stock market crashed and that GDP is declining. So, I've called him Teflon Trump. He may end up being Teflon vis-a-vis the COVID-19 as well, because he will be able to say, well, yeah, nature does bat last, and it wasn't me that is the cause of this. But on the other hand, I think that'll be pretty much equally argued against, in the sense that, well, it just goes to show that anyone who is obsessed with GDP growth and tells you that they're going to be able to grow the economy at 3% a year no matter what, well, first of all, that wasn't a smart thing to pursue to begin with,
mm-hmm.
and secondly, they're not going to be able to do that except for brief periods of time, if anything, at this point.
Well, so Dr. Brian Cech, founder and executive director of the Center for the Advancement of a Steady State Economy, you really need to change that name. What are you folks doing to work with the Democrats and the two remaining Democratic candidates, and of course the Democratic Party, to urge them to look at legislation and policy changes that will start to pull us back from the notion that GDP growth is the panacea that it isn't?
Well, we're not working closely with the two remaining campaigns in the Democratic Party. I think we can take a little bit of credit for the Cory Booker statement to begin with. We met with them, and and encourage them to take a baby step that would probably work in terms of, you know, defeating the Trumpian focus of GDP growth. And they did, and I think that's a wonderful precedent. I'm sure it did not escape notice of the Sanders or Biden campaigns. I think the Biden campaign is pretty tied into economic growth traditionally, and the Sanders campaign probably a little less so. But in terms of us working directly with them, you know, a political campaign at the presidential level, it's a little bit analogous to the stock market. Once a stock is all the rage, well, it's hard to get any at a decent price. And so, similarly, it's difficult to get into the inner circles of a Biden or Sanders at this point. But we're working on it more so with the case of Sanders, because we do have a number of Vermont. We have a pretty decent network in Vermont that connects fairly well politically. The lieutenant governor of Vermont signed the Cassie position on economic growth just a few weeks ago. Yes, and the Vermont legislature has recognized Cassie as having an important message to be considered in the planning of state economic policy at this point. So, yeah, I think there's a decent chance we can break through to the Sanders campaign before it's decided who's going to be the actual nominee.
Well, and it sounds to me then that once, with great hope, the Democrats have won the presidency, that they will then populate their cabinet with folks like Yang and Booker and Kamala Harris, folks who support the idea of a steady state economy, and you might have a better opportunity to work with them. We're going to have to close in about a minute. There was a quote that you had in your article, and I want to recommend this to folks. Go to steadystate.org. Brian Check, our guest today, has written a great article about how the Dems might beat Trump on the economy. But there's a great quote here from Robert Kennedy in 1968, where he said, "Too much and for too long, we seem to have surrendered personal excellence and community values in the mere accumulation of material things. Yet the gross national product does not allow for the health of our children, the quality of their education, or the joy of their play. It does not include the beauty of our poetry, or the strength of our marriages, the intelligence of our public debate, or the integrity of our public officials. It measures neither our wit nor our courage, neither our wisdom nor our learning, neither our compassion nor our devotion to our country. It measures everything, in short, except that which makes life worthwhile. And it can tell us everything about America except why we are proud that we are Americans." Wow.
Yes, that was powerful stuff.
And, that was.
Andrew Yang's statement was quite Kennedy-esque, you might say.
Yes, it was. It was. And I feel that there's an overall move toward the people, a country that we can be proud of that serves the people beyond the 1%. Brian Check, it's always a joy talking with you. Thank you so much for joining us here on Real Talk.
Thank you, Susan. Take care.
And we'll bring you back. Thank
okay.
you. Thank you for listening, dear listeners. You've been listening to Real Talk on the Voice of Vashon at KVSHLP, Vashon Island, Washington. And it's also available at your convenience at voiceofvashon.org/realtalk. Stay tuned for The Captain's Chair, live with Joe Wobble.